I'm going to tell you about what I do support, which is free software. Sigil, Glenn Kien. It's clearer to say it in Chinese because the English word free could be misunderstood. Sometimes people think it means yan fei. But this is an issue of freedom, not price. So think of free speech, not free beer. I don't really care whether copies of software are distributed gratis or whether somebody pays for them. Either one is okay. As long as we respect the user's freedom, freedom is what's important. So the thing that's bad about Windows or macOS is not that people pay to get copies, if they do, because many people don't pay. The thing that's bad is that the developer has power over the user, unjust power. A proprietary program keeps the users divided and helpless. Divided because everyone is forbidden to share it. And helpless because the users don't have the source code. So they can't change it. They can't even tell what the program is really doing to them. And many non-free programs do very nasty things. So, free software means software that respects the user's freedom. But that's a very general statement. It's very easy to say, I am in favor of freedom. If you don't say what it means, then it doesn't mean anything. Even Bush says he's in favor of freedom. And Bush doesn't understand freedom even after he crushes it. So, we have to be specific. We have to say what freedom it is. A program is free software if it gives the user the four essential freedoms. Freedom zero is the freedom to run the program as you wish. Freedom one is the freedom to study the source code of the program and change it so the program does what you wish. Freedom two is the freedom to help your neighbor. That's the freedom to make exact copies of the program and distribute them to others when you wish. And this includes giving them away, and it includes selling them, whichever you wish. And freedom three is the freedom to contribute to your community. That is the freedom to make copies of your modified versions and distribute them to others when you wish. If you have all four of these freedoms, then the program is free software, which means that the social system of the distribution and use of this program is an ethical system, one that respects the freedom of each user and respects the social solidarity of the community. However, if any of these freedoms is missing or insufficient, then the program is proprietary software, user subjugating software, which means that the social system of its distribution and use is unethical. That program should not exist. Developing a proprietary program is not a contribution to society. It's an attack on society. It's a power grab. It's an attempt to subjugate people. If the program has any useful features, those are bait for a trap. Because if you use the program, your freedom is gone. So if you want to live in freedom, you have to reject those programs. It's the only way. If you use that program, any proprietary program, it takes away your freedom. To keep your freedom, don't use proprietary programs. But why are these four freedoms essential? Why define free software this way? Each freedom has a reason. Freedom two, the freedom to help your neighbor. The freedom to make and distribute exact copies is essential on basic moral grounds. So you can live an upright, ethical life as a good member of your community. If you use a program that doesn't give you freedom number two, you are in danger of falling into a moral dilemma at any moment. Whenever your friend says, "That's a nice program, could I have a copy?" At that moment, you will face a choice between two evils. One evil is to give your friend a copy and violate the license of the program. The other evil is to deny your friend a copy and comply with the license of the program. If you are in the dilemma, you want to choose the lesser evil, which is to give your friend a copy and violate the license of the program. Why is this the lesser evil? Because if you can't escape doing wrong to somebody or other, better to do wrong to somebody who deserves it because he has acted wrong. We can assume that your friend is a good friend and a good member of your community and normally deserves your cooperation. By contrast, the developer of the proprietary program has deliberately attacked the social solidarity of your community. So if you have to do wrong to one or the other, do it to the developer. He deserves it. But being the lesser evil does not make it good. It's never a good thing to make an agreement and then break it. Now, there are some agreements that are inherently evil, and keeping them is worse than breaking them. But breaking them is not good. This is an example of such an agreement. To keep the agreement is really bad, but breaking it is still bad. And if you give your friend a copy, what will he have? He will have an unauthorized copy of a proprietary program. Something pretty bad. Almost as bad as an authorized copy. So, when you fully understand this issue, what should you do? What you should do is make sure you never fall into this dilemma. There are two ways to do that. One is, don't have any friends. That's the method implicitly suggested by the developers of proprietary software. The other is, reject proprietary software. If you don't have a copy of the program, then you are safe. You can't fall into the dilemma. That's my solution. If a program is not free software, I reject it because my conscience requires me to reject it. If someone offers me an attractive program on the condition that I promise not to share it with you, I will say no.
because it would be unethical for me to accept the condition. We have to reject proprietary software, and we also have to reject the propaganda terms that our enemies use to demonize sharing and cooperation. For instance, they call sharing piracy. What are they saying when they do that? They are trying to equate helping your neighbor with attacking a ship. And nothing could be more wrong than that equation, because attacking ships is very bad, but helping your neighbor is the right thing to do. So don't call it piracy. When someone asks me what I think of piracy, I say, I think attacking ships is very bad. And when somebody asks me what I think of software piracy, I say, as far as I know, pirates use guns, not software. So that's the reason for freedom number two, the freedom to help your neighbor, the freedom to make exact copies and distribute them to others. And this includes both commercially and non-commercially. It includes Mianfei, it includes charging a price for the copy. Any of these ways, you should be free to do them. Freedom zero, the freedom to run the program as you wish, is essential for a different reason, so you can control your computing. It may be surprising, may be shocking, but there are proprietary programs that restrict even the use of authorized copies. For instance, they may restrict which computer you can run them on, or who is allowed to run them, or for how long, or for what purpose. This is not controlling your computing. So freedom zero is essential. In fact, for many years, I thought it didn't need to be mentioned. I thought it goes without saying. And when I did add it, when I realized that we had to mention it explicitly, I put it at the beginning and gave it number zero, because it's so fundamental. You must be free to run the program as you wish. But that is not enough, because that just means you can do or not do whatever the code permits. So the developer still has power over you, not through the license, but instead through the code. So you also need freedom number one, the freedom to study the source code and change it so the program does what you wish. This way you decide instead of letting the developer decide for you. If you use a program without freedom one, you can't even tell what it's really doing to you. Many of these programs have malicious features. They're designed to spy on the user, restrict the user, even attack the user. For instance, many programs spy on the user. One proprietary program that spies on the user that you may have heard of is called Microsoft Windows. When the user of Windows, and I don't say you because I'm sure you wouldn't use a nasty program like this, when the user of Windows invokes the menu feature to search her own files for a word, Windows sends a message to Microsoft saying what word was searched for. That's one spy feature. And when Windows XP asks for an upgrade, it sends Microsoft a list of all the software installed in the machine. Another spy feature. Microsoft never announced these spy features. People discovered them through investigation. So it's quite possible that that Windows spies on the user in other ways as well that people have not discovered yet. There's no way of being sure. But spying on the user is not limited to Windows. Windows Media Player also spies on the user. In fact, it does total surveillance. It reports everything the user looks at. But please don't think that Microsoft is uniquely evil and that only Microsoft would do such a nasty thing. Because RealPlayer spies on the user the same way. And we are almost certain that RealPlayer did it first. And besides, Microsoft is more known for imitation than for invention. Lots of proprietary programs spy on the user, but it gets worse. There is also the functionality of refusing to function, where the program says, I don't want to show you the contents of this file, even though it's in your computer. I don't want to let you copy part of this file, even though it's in your computer. I don't want to print this file for you, because I don't like you. These programs really don't like you. They were not developed to serve you. They were developed to keep you in chains. They're not your servants, they are your prison guards. These malicious features designed to restrict the user are also known as DRM, Digital Restrictions Management. The intentional malicious feature of refusing to function for you. Many companies do this nasty thing. Microsoft does it. Apple does it. Google does it. Adobe does it. Sony does it. Amazon does it. And many others. It's a big threat to our freedom because every product with digital restrictions management attacks your freedom at two levels at the same time. First of all, the purpose of digital restrictions management is to attack your freedom. It's designed to stop you from fully utilizing your copies of various works. It's designed to control you. So that's attacking your freedom. But it also attacks your freedom at another level, which is that those works can only be accessed through non-free software, at least most of the time. And the reason is they are published in secret formats. It's hard to write free software to access those copies because we don't know the format they're in. And in many countries, if we do find out the format, and if we do develop and release free software, that software is censored. Now, censorship, of course, is a very bad thing, and there are many countries that practice it. In the United States, the free software to watch the movie on a DVD has been censored. The distribution of that software is forbidden. Because this is so dangerous, we have a campaign of protests against DRM. You can find it in the site defectivebydesign.org. Because all products with digital restrictions management are designed to be defective. They are designed not to work right. and you should refuse to tolerate that. So the first protest is never buy those products. Never buy anything, or never accept anything with DRM unless you personally have the means to break the DRM. Don't buy it, don't rent it, don't accept it as a gift. Just don't allow it in your life. So if you have the free software to play a DVD, then you can get DVDs. But other than that, don't get them. The first step in winning freedom is to make the decision that you will not give up your freedom just because of a momentary pleasure. So if a product is designed specifically to attack your freedom, don't accept it. Don't take it. And then go to defectivebydesign.org so you can participate in our protest actions. Many of them are done through the internet, and you can do them from wherever you are. But it gets even worse. There is also the malicious feature designed to attack the user. Backdoors. One proprietary program you may have heard of that has a backdoor is called Microsoft Windows. You see, starting with Windows XP, Microsoft arranged to find out the user's identity, more or less. And that means that when Windows XP asks for an upgrade, Microsoft can deliver to that user an upgrade designed specifically for him, which means, in effect, that Microsoft can take control of his machine and do to him whatever it wants. That user is completely at Microsoft's mercy. That's the backdoor we know about, because we can deduce it from known facts. But there may be others. A few years ago in India, people told me that they had arrested some of the developers of Windows and accused them of working simultaneously for Microsoft and Al-Qaeda, trying to install another backdoor which Microsoft was not supposed to know about. This attempt apparently failed. Was there another that succeeded? We don't know. But we know that Microsoft itself installed a backdoor for the use of another terrorist organization, even more violent than Al-Qaeda, namely the United States government. Which did something in Iraq, which can best be understood by comparison with China's conquest of Tibet. So, what this shows is that you can't trust any non-free program without Freedom One. These programs are just trust me software. They demand that the user place blind faith in the developer, because you can't check anything. All you can do is give blind faith. And yet we know that many of these developers betray that faith. They do it whenever it suits them. You simply cannot trust them. Now, with Windows XP, the user at least has the option of turning off upgrades. this might be dangerous in other ways, but at least means that Microsoft can't give you a malicious upgrade. So, of course, with Windows Vista, Microsoft eliminated this option. Windows Vista gives Microsoft the power to force changes in software at any time. But please don't think that Microsoft is uniquely evil and that only Microsoft would do this. Because I'm told that Mac OS X has the same capability. Apple can impose changes in software at any time. So to say that Microsoft and Apple can take control of the user's computer is an understatement. The fact is, they always have control. They have control from the first time that the machine goes on the net. And they always have total control over that user. Now, in some of these proprietary programs, we know of malicious features. In the rest, we don't know of any. Now, they may have malicious features or not. Some of them have malicious features and some don't. But we don't know which is which. The only way we can be certain is when we find a malicious feature and then we put the program in this group. So when the program is in this group, we don't know which of them have malicious features and which don't. So I'm sure there are plenty that have no malicious features, but we can't identify any of them with certainty. But we can make a statement about them, and that is their developers are human, so they make mistakes. The code of those programs has bugs. And the user of a program without freedom number one is just as helpless facing an accidental bug as facing a deliberate malicious feature. If you use a program without freedom one, you are a prisoner of your software. We, the developers of free software, are also human. We also make mistakes, and the code of our programs also has bugs. But if you find a bug in our code, or anything in our code that you don't like, you can change it, because we did not make you a prisoner. We can't be perfect. We can respect your freedom. However, freedom one is not enough, because that's the freedom to personally study and change the source code. That's not enough because there are millions of users that don't know how to program. They don't know how to exercise freedom number one. They can't exercise it directly. But even for programmers like me, freedom one is not enough because there's just too much software in the world. There's too much free software in the world today for any one person to study it all and master it all and personally make all the changes that she might want. That's beyond the capabilities of any one human being. So the only way we can fully take control of our computing and make all the changes we want is to do it working together, cooperating. And for that, we need freedom three, the freedom to contribute to your community, the freedom to make and distribute copies of your modified versions. That allows us to work together, because if a bunch of people would like progress in a certain direction, somebody can take the existing program and make a change and release his modified version. And then somebody else can start with that and make another change and release her modified version. And then somebody else can start with that and make another change and release his modified version. And the result will be, speaking from the viewpoint of hindsight, we will say that they cooperated to make this change. And that's how, in the free software world, we shape programs to do what we want. And thus, all the users get the benefit of the four freedoms. Every user can exercise freedom 0 and freedom 2. The freedom to run the program as you wish, and the freedom to distribute exact copies. Because these don't require programming. You don't have to know how to program to do these things. Freedoms 1 and 3, the freedom to study and change the source code, and the freedom to distribute copies of your version, these require programming. So any given user can exercise these freedoms more or less, depending on how much that user knows how to program. And there are users, many of them, that don't know any programming and they don't want to. So they can't directly exercise these freedoms. But when other people, the programmers, exercise these freedoms and release their modified versions, those non-programmer users can install those modified versions if they wish. So they get the benefit of living in a society where other people, where everyone has those four freedoms. And this makes it like freedom of the press. You see, most people never write articles about their political opinions for publication. Most people don't have the skill to write a publishable article. But we all get the benefit of living in a society where people are free to publish their opinions. Because even if you don't write an article about your opinions, somebody else that agrees with you will write an article and publish it. So it's very important for all of us to have freedom of the press, even if many of us never choose to exercise it. And the combined result of these four freedoms is democracy. A free program develops democratically under the control of its users. The users decide how the program will develop, and every user can participate as much as she wishes in society's decision about the future of the program. Because that decision is simply the sum total of all the individual decisions. Because with free software, every user has freedom, this also means that nobody has power over anybody else. This is why we don't find malicious features in free software. Because nobody can put them in and force other people not to take them out. Nobody can put them in and impose them on the users. Yes, you could put one in. You could implement a malicious feature in a free program. And somebody else could remove the malicious feature. Anybody who wants to can remove it. And the result is everybody will switch to the improved version, the version where the malicious feature has been removed, and this attempt to restrict other people or spy on them will have failed. A free software developer can try to put in a malicious feature, but because he doesn't have power, he can't force people to keep it. So they will get rid of it. By contrast, a proprietary program develops under the dictatorship of its developer and functions as an instrument of the developer's power, imposing that person's power over all the users. This is why proprietary software often has malicious features, because the developer knows that if he puts in a malicious feature, nobody else can take it out. He has total power over what the program will do and over what happens to all the users. So society faces a choice. On one hand, we have individual freedom, social solidarity, and democracy. On the other, we have dictatorship of software developers who bully and mistreat the users. Our choice is clear. We must insist on free software. We must put an end to proprietary software. So the aim of the free software movement is the liberation of cyberspace. We hope that each one of you will escape from proprietary software and come to the free world. The free world is a new continent that we have built in cyberspace so that we can live here in freedom. Because it's a virtual continent, there is room for everybody and there are no immigration restrictions. Everyone is welcome. And because there were never any indigenous peoples in cyberspace, we also don't have to think about the issue of chasing them off their land. So cyberspace is a new area. There is the feudal world where the old world of cyberspace, where every program has its lord, and this lord bullies and mistreats the users. That's proprietary software. And there is the free world, where the software is free, so all the users are free. I hope that you will all join us, escape to the free world. It's impossible to live in freedom in the feudal world of proprietary software without a revolution. But instead of, we don't even have to bother, we just invite everybody to leave and come to the free world. And someday this world, this proprietary world will shrink down to zero and it will be gone. How did I come to these ideas? In the 1970s, I went to work at a lab at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And in that lab, we had a free software community. We used entirely free software. We had an operating system that was free software. My job was system hacker, which meant I was supposed to improve this free operating system in any way I could think of. So I would write an improvement, I would install it, users would give me feedback, they would report bugs, I would fix them, and so on, over and over. And I was one of many people doing this. We were very glad to share our software with anybody that would like it. And if anybody wanted to help work on it, that was wonderful. People who we didn't know, they would come in and they'd say, this computer is fun, can I work on it? And we would say, great, what can you do? So in this way, I learned how good it is to be part of a free software community. I learned that this is the right way to live, sharing knowledge with other people. But then we had a taste of proprietary software. When Xerox gave the lab a printer, a laser printer, and this printer was controlled by proprietary software. It was the first time we had any proprietary software. And it was a big problem because it didn't work very well. And I wanted to make improvements in it, but I couldn't because we didn't have the source code. So I was blocked from even trying. And then I found out that somebody at another university had a copy of that source code. So I visited, I went to his office and I said, "Hi, I'm from MIT. Could I have a copy of the printer software source code?" And he said, "No, I promised not to give you a copy." And I was stunned. I was so shocked, I couldn't think of anything to do except walk out of his office without saying a word to him. But because it hurt so much, I thought about it. I realized that he had betrayed his community by promising not to cooperate with us. He had betrayed us by refusing us the cooperation that was normal in our community. But he did worse than that, because he didn't just promise not to share it with us, he also promised not to share it with you and everybody else in the world. He had betrayed the whole world, and it made me think of Cao Cao. Except he was worse than Cao Cao, because Cao Cao only spoke about the idea of betraying the whole world. He actually did it. So thinking about this, I realized that the non-disclosure agreement he had signed was evil. Whenever someone offers you some information and says you have to promise you won't give it to anybody else, he is asking you to be like Cao Cao. He is asking you to betray the whole world. So that's when thinking about that, I decided that I would never sign such an agreement. I concluded people should never sign those agreements. It's wrong. In the early 1980s, the free software community died. And the computer that our free operating system ran on became obsolete. And the operating system would be considered obsolete and not very good by today's standards. So I had to think, what was I going to do with the rest of my life? Around me, all computers ran with proprietary software. In 1983, every computer you could get needed proprietary software in order to work. And I had concluded that proprietary software was an evil, unethical way of life. What was I going to do? The only good thing I could do with my life was to try to change that, to make it possible once again to use computers with free software. And that's what I decided to do. But since I was just one man, not famous, and with no political skill, I concluded that trying to organize a political movement to change the practice of proprietary software would probably not get anywhere. But I found another way I could do it. I realized that if I could develop another operating system, then I could make it free, since I would be the author. And that way, everybody would be able to use computers and have freedom. They would just have to use my system. In other words, I had discovered a way that through technical work, I could give freedom to all computer users, or at least all the ones who would want it. In other words, I found a way to correct a social problem through technical work. So I was aware of an important and growing social problem, which most people did not recognize as a problem. I had the skills necessary to try to correct the problem, and it looked like nobody else would do it if I did not. That meant I had been elected by circumstances to do this work. It was my duty. It's as if you see somebody drowning and you know how to swim and there's no one else around and it's not Bush, then you have a moral duty to save that person. Well, I don't know how to swim. But in this case, the job was not swimming. The job was writing an operating system. And that I knew how to do. So I decided I would develop a free software operating system or die trying. Of old age, presumably. Because at the time, the free software movement, which I was just launching, had no active enemies. Lots of people disagreed with it, but they just said, oh, that's silly, and then they ignored it. So the obstacle was not opposition. The obstacle was a pile of programs we would have to develop to have a complete free operating system. And at the time, nobody knew if we would ever finish this job. Nobody knew if we would ever have a complete free operating system. But I decided to try anyway. Because when it's a matter of fighting for freedom, you can't afford to wait until victory is just within reach before you start. Because if you wait that long, you miss most of the opportunities. You have to start the struggle when victory is very far away and you don't know whether you're going to win. Because at least that way you have a chance to win. So I decided to develop a free software operating system. I decided to recruit others to help so we would get it done sooner. I decided to make it follow the design of Unix so it would be portable. I had already seen one free operating system become obsolete because the computer it ran on became obsolete. I didn't want that to happen again. So I wanted to make a portable system. And following the design of Unix was a good way to do that. Then I decided to make it compatible with Unix so that the many users of Unix could easily switch. And that had an interesting consequence. That made the initial design decisions. You see, the design of Unix is a bunch of separate components. To be compatible means you have to replace each component in a compatible way. So the whole job had been broken down into small jobs. We just had to replace each component one by one. So the only other thing that I needed to start the project was a name. in the community, the free software community we had in the 1970s, we were programming for the fascination of programming. And because we were doing this for fun, we tried to make it more fun. So we would often give our programs funny names too. That way we could enjoy thinking about how the users would laugh. And we had a... Now, in the 1970s, system-level programming was generally not portable. So, very often you would see an interesting program that ran on some other kind of computer, and the only way you could have that on your computer was to write another program. So you would do it. In our community, we had a special tradition. When you did that, right, that is, when you wrote a program similar to an existing program, you could give your program a name, which was a recursive acronym, saying your program is not the other one. So, for instance, in 1976, I developed the first Emacs text editor, an extensible, customizable text editor. You could reprogram the editor during your editing session. And after that, there were about 30 imitations of Emacs, each one typically for a different computer system. And some of them were called this or that Emacs, which is obvious and not funny. But there was also Fine, for Fine is not Emacs. And there was Sign, for Sign is not Emacs. And there was Ina, for Ina is not Emacs. And there was Mince, for Mince is not complete Emacs. And version 2 of Ina was called Zwei, for Zwei was Ina initially. Now, Ina and Zwei are more or less the numbers 1 and 2 in German. So, calling version 2 the number 2 was also funny. So I looked for a recursive acronym for something is not Unix, blank I-N-U. But none of those things have a meaning, and if it doesn't have another meaning, it's not funny. So I thought about, I had to look further to find a recursive acronym, and I tried making a contraction. I decided I could get rid of the word is by changing it to apostrophe S, and I could have something's not Unix, blank N-U. So I tried every initial, anu, gnu, knu, dnu, enu, fnu, gnu. Well, gnu is the funniest word in the English language. It's used for countless word plays. And the reason is, according to the dictionary, the G is silent, and it's pronounced gnu. So every time you want to write the word gnu, you can write it G-N-U, and you have a joke. Maybe not a very good joke, but there are lots of them. And sometimes it is a good joke. For instance, when I was a child, there was a funny song called I'm a GNU. So this was the most wonderful name you could possibly find for any software package. And I couldn't resist it. But when it's the name of this system, please do not follow the dictionary. If you talk about the new operating system, you'll get people confused. It's been almost 25 years since I announced it. We've been developing it for 24 years and using it for 15. So it's not new anymore. But it still is GNU. And it will always be GNU, despite all those people who erroneously call it Linux. Now, you heard that earlier. The previous speaker was talking about Linux, and what he meant was the GNU system. And that's not fair to us, so please don't do that. You see, there really is Linux, but it's not the whole system. Linux is one component. It's called the kernel. That's the program that allocates the computer's resources to the other programs that you run. That is a major essential component, and it doesn't come from the GNU project. It's not part of the GNU system. But since the GNU kernel doesn't really work very well, we don't use it. Instead, we use the GNU system with Linux as the kernel. So this combination is the GNU plus Linux system. And please call it that. If you call the whole thing Linux, then first of all, you're causing confusion because Linux really means this one part. If you call the whole thing Linux, people can't tell what you mean. But second, since we in the GNU project started it and we did the biggest part of the job, you really ought to give us equal mention. We deserve that much. So please distinguish between Linux the kernel and the GNU slash Linux operating system. Linux is one component of this system, but you can't install and run Linux by itself on a PC. It won't actually enable you to type any commands. It won't allow you to run any other programs. There's no job you can do. So you need the whole system. And that whole system is more GNU than anything else. So by calling the whole system GNU slash Linux, first of all, you give us a share of the credit. And second, you help educate other people to understand the difference between a complete system and a kernel. The development of Linux, the kernel, was an important contribution to the free software community. At that time, we had all the rest of the GNU system, but we didn't have this one piece. So before I should point out, though, that when Linux was first released, it was not free software. In 1991, the first release had a license that was too restrictive. However, in 1992, the developer, Torvalds, changed the license. He adopted the GNU General Public License, which is one of many free software licenses. And that meant that Linux became free software. So the combination of Linux and the incomplete GNU system was a complete free system. And for the first time, it was possible to buy a PC and install a complete free operating system and use it in freedom. In effect, the development of Linux was the step that carried us across the finish line. It was able to carry us across the finish line because we had taken lots of steps already, and we were already pretty close. But Torvalds, the developer of Linux, never agreed with our ideas of free software. He made Linux free software almost as almost by accident. It wasn't literally an accident. He chose the GNU GPL as the license, but he chose it for other reasons. He didn't choose it because he wanted the users to have freedom. He chose it because it seemed that it would be more successful that way. Well, it's still a good thing that he did so. But the point is that Torvalds disagrees with the ideas of the free software movement that I've been telling you today. And that's why calling the system Linux is really harmful. Because when people think the system is Linux, they think it was all started by Torvalds. So they look to Torvalds for ethical guidance. And what does he say to them? He rejects the idea of freedom as a goal. He denounces it. He says that the goals are powerful and reliable software. Well, he has a right to his views. He has a right to present his views. Everyone should have a right to present his views. But it's not a good thing that our tremendous development effort that we made specifically for your freedom is attributed to him, and he uses it as a platform to reject freedom. And what's especially bad is what happens when people listen to him. You see, they think he developed the whole system. They think the system comes from his vision. So they follow his vision. And that means they don't care about their own freedom. And people who don't care about their freedom are in danger of losing it. Freedom is frequently threatened. In order to keep their freedom, people have to be ready to defend their freedom. The GNU project is based on these ideas of freedom, and we urge people, we teach people to value freedom and defend it. But Torvalds has views of a different kind, views that today are known as open source. And they don't talk about freedom at all. So those views will never show people why they should care about their freedom. They won't lead people to campaign for freedom or defend their freedom. And the result of having many people in our community that hold open source views is that our freedom is weak. We're in danger of losing it. In fact, that has already happened. In 1992, you could get the GNU plus Linux system, and it was free software, and you could install it in a PC. At that point, people started working on various distributions of GNU/Linux, trying to make it easier to install. And so by 1994 or 5, there were a number of different distributions. And they were competing with each other. And one distribution developer thought, we can get an advantage if we add some proprietary programs that will make our distribution more attractive. So they did, and they said, users, choose our distribution. Look at this bonus you get. And they were talking about proprietary programs. Well, then the developer of another distribution looked at that and said, uh-oh, they have an advantage. The users are switching to that distribution because of those proprietary programs. We're losing. We have to put in the proprietary programs also. And so, as the years went on, the distributions more and more put in proprietary software. And by the end of the 90s, there was no free distribution. By then, there were hundreds of distributions of GNU/Linux, and every one of them had proprietary software. So we had reached freedom in 1992, and then we fell away from it because we didn't care enough. Because people thought that success was more important than freedom. Well, I'm happy to say that today there are some free distributions. For instance, there is Ututo, U-T-U-T-O. And there is BLAG, which stands for BLAG, Linux, and GNU. And there is GNUSense, G-N-E-W-S-E-N-S-E. These distributions have the policy of rejecting non-free software. But these are not the best known distributions. The distributions that you mainly hear about are the ones that still contain non-free software. So we reached freedom, we fell completely away from it, and now we're beginning to climb up. But we still have a ways to go. And what message does this convey to the public, to the users, when they see these well-known distributions that contain non-free software or offer or recommend the installation of non-free software? What message does that convey? The message it conveys is freedom is not so important. Convenience is more important. And that message works against the free software movement. That's why I don't allow partially free distributions to be distributed at my speeches. People want to do that, and I tell them no, because that would undermine the message of my speech. And I had to do that here. There was a not entirely free distribution being offered on CDs, and I said, you can't distribute that here. Because it's not enough to use mostly free software. The point is, every non-free program takes away your freedom, and we have to reject them. And we have to act in a way that's consistent with our views. And that's why I won't recommend any of those partially free distributions. I don't want them distributed at my speeches, because if they are, it looks like I am recommending them and endorsing them. And if people think that I endorse them, that totally confuses the message that I'm giving. In fact, today, even Linux isn't free software. That is, the usual version of Linux is not free software. The version that Torvalds maintains contains, it's mostly free software, but there are parts which are not free. And these parts are called blobs. They are binary executable programs for which source code is not available. And they are disguised as source code, but because they're part of a file of C source. But they're not really source code. They are tables of thousands of numbers. And those numbers are really a program in executable form. So we now maintain a free version of Linux to use in free GNU/Linux systems. And this free version of Linux does not have the blobs. So as you can see, freedom is never guaranteed. If you have freedom today, that doesn't mean you will have freedom in 5 years. You always have to keep working to maintain freedom. But it's very important to do this. In fact, we need to teach various social institutions to support freedom. And one thing we need to do is teach the schools to stop using and stop teaching proprietary software. Every school should teach exclusively free software. And there are 4 reasons for this. The most superficial reason is to save money. Schools do not have enough money. They are limited by their budgets. So schools should not pay for permission to run proprietary software. This is a very superficial and obvious reason. Even people who don't understand free software, people who mistakenly think it means miễn phí, they can understand this reason at least. But there are some proprietary software companies that eliminate this reason by offering gratis copies, or nearly gratis, of their non-free software to the schools. And why do they do this? Is it because they are idealistic and they want to encourage education? I don't think so. Instead, they are trying to corrupt the schools and use them as an instrument to make society dependent on that non-free software. Here's how it works. They donate these gratis but not free programs to the schools. The schools teach the students to use them and create a dependency. The students become dependent on that software. And then they graduate with this dependency. And after they graduate, this company is not going to offer them gratis copies anymore. And those students go to work for companies. Well, this developer is not going to offer gratis copies to those companies. So the idea is the school pushes the students into the path of dependency. And they draw and pull all of society along with them into permanent dependency on this proprietary software. It's just like donating gratis doses of an addictive drug to the school, saying, inject these into your students and make them dependent. Of course, the first dose is gratis. Afterwards, you have to pay. The school would not accept this donation of addictive drugs, and it should not accept this donation of addictive software either, because the school has a social mission, and that mission is to educate the next generation to be good citizens of a strong, capable, independent, cooperating, and free society. And the only way to do that is to teach them to be free software users. But there's a deeper reason, and that is for the education of the best programmers. Some people are natural-born programmers, and at the age of 13 or so, they are fascinated with computers and software, And if they use a program, they want to know, how does this work? But when this youth asks the teacher, how does this program work? If it's proprietary, the teacher can only say, I'm sorry, I don't know, it's a secret. And there is no room for education. Proprietary software is against the spirit of education. But if the program is free, the teacher can explain what he knows and then say, here's a copy of the source code. Read it and you'll understand everything. And that youth will read it because he yearns to understand everything. And the teacher can say, if you come to any point that you can't figure out, show it to me and we'll figure it out together. And this gives that young programmer the opportunity to learn something very important. Don't write it that way. Anything that even he can't figure out must be really hard to understand, and you shouldn't write it that way. You see, you don't have to teach these people to program because they are natural born programmers. They read a manual and they say, oh, programming is that, well, of course. But learning to program well is something else. The way you learn to program well is by reading lots of code and writing lots of code. Only free software gives you the chance to do this. The way you learn to write code for large programs is you have to start small. That is, small pieces of code to go into large programs. Small programs are not even a start. You know, if you write a small program, you don't even begin to deal with the issues of large programs. So the way to deal with those issues as a beginner is to write a small piece of code to add to an existing large program. And that's also what you will be doing most of the time as a system developer, because most of the work is to add to an existing program. Starting a new program, that's a rare event. Adding to one, that's what you do every day. So, only free software gives you this opportunity. This is how I learned. I went to work at the Artificial Intelligence Lab, and we had a free operating system. So I was able to do this. This is how I got to be good. Today, any school can offer the same opportunity, but only if it's a free software school. But there is an even deeper reason, and that is for the sake of education in citizenship, ethical education. Because every school has to teach not just facts and not just techniques, but above all, the spirit of goodwill and the habit of helping your neighbor. So every class has to have this rule. Students, if you bring software to class, you may not keep it for yourself. You must share it with everyone else in the class. However, the school has to practice its own rule to set a good example. The school must bring only free software to class. Every school of every level, if it has computers, it has to bring only free software to class and teach the students to use free software. Those of you who are students or teachers or have anything to do with schools, you should campaign for this. Now, to end my speech, I will present my other identity.
I'm not done yet.
I am Saint Ignatius of the Church of Emacs. I bless your computer, my child. Emacs started out as a text editor, which became a way of life for many users because it was extended so much that they could do all their work inside of Emacs. And then it became a church with the launch of the news group alt.religion.emacs. Today in the Church of Emacs, we have a great schism between several rival versions of Emacs. And we also have saints, but fortunately no gods. Instead of gods, we worship an editor. To be a member of the Church of Emacs, you must recite the Confession of the Faith. You must say, there is no system but GNU, and Linux is one of its kernels. The Church of Emacs has certain advantages compared with some other churches I won't name. For instance, to be a saint in the Church of Emacs does not require celibacy. So, if you have been searching for a church to be saintly in, you might want to consider ours. But it does require living a life of moral purity. You must exorcise whatever evil proprietary operating systems have possessed computers under your control, and then install a wholly free operating system, where wholly can be spelled in more than one way, and then only install free software with and on the operating system. If you make this vow and you live by it, then you too will be a saint, and you too will have the right to wear a halo if you can find one because they don't make them anymore. Sometimes people ask me whether it is a sin in the Church of Emacs to use the other editor, VI. It's true that VI is the editor of the beast in Roman numerals, but using a free implementation of VI is not a sin, it's a penance because it's much less convenient. Sometimes people ask me whether my halo is really an old computer disk. This is no computer disk, this is my halo. But it was a computer disk in a previous existence. So thank you. I will answer questions in a couple of minutes. Right now, I have to take a brief trip.